Trauma Therapist Podcast, episode 162.
Passion, dedication, and inspiration. If you're ready to hear inspiring interviews with amazing trauma therapists, this is it. Right here, right now. With your host, Guy McPherson.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. My name is Guy McPherson, and just really excited to introduce to you tonight, Crystal Arbour. Crystal, you ready to do this?
I am. Thank you.
You're welcome. So Crystal is a registered social worker with the British Columbia College of Social Work. Her area of expertise is a treatment of complex trauma using EMDR. Working on the downtown east side of Vancouver, Canada's poorest postal code, Crystal has pioneered the use of EMDR with concurrent disordered clients, a population previously thought to be too unstable to benefit. Crystal has empowered these clients to manage their most severe PTSD symptoms through a psychoeducational and skills-based group called Making Sense of Trauma. The group has graduated over 100 members, and its success has led to Crystal becoming a lead educator in trauma-informed practice in both the public and private sectors. Crystal also has a private practice specializing in trauma and family therapy, and can be followed on her blog, www.worthit2bme.com. I'll have that linked up at the show notes page. So Crystal, welcome.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. So share with our listeners where you're calling from, where you're from, and then let's dive in.
Okay. So I'm calling from Vancouver, Canada. And actually right now I'm sitting in North Van, but that's I work in Vancouver and in North Vancouver actually.
Okay. And are you originally from Canada?
I am. Oh, yeah. Cool. Born in Vancouver and raised on the island.
Nice.
Here in BC. Yeah.
Awesome. I've never been there, but I hear it's pretty amazing.
It's quite beautiful.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting bio there. I'm really excited to hear about your experience and just everything you have to share. So let's start off here with a kind of a quote, a mantra, something to kind of give our listeners and to set the stage, to kind of give us some context to what kind of inspires you. What would you like to share?
Okay. So I picked a quote that's probably not that popular, but super exciting for me. And that is a quote by Dr. Stephen Porges. So immobilization is a hardwired reaction, not a personal fault. And I absolutely love this. And the reason I love this is because I think it's really helped change the way we understand trauma, the way we treat trauma. It's really helped folks, especially folks in my who attend my Making Sense of Trauma group, understand that the freeze response is a hardwired response. That yes, we can fight or flight, but also the option of freeze is there. It's not a choice. It sometimes happens. For those who've grown up in homes where there was a lot of chaos or neglect, people can end up freezing. And then this, of course, becomes their way of responding, even as an adult. I just love it because it helps free people from shaming themselves.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So just to get that right, immobilization is a hardwired action, not a
reaction.
Okay, not a personalized fault.
Yes, personal fault. Yeah,
personal fault. Okay.
Yeah. And I've had a lot of people come to me in tears after they hear this because they say to me, you know, I always thought that there was something wrong with me, that I didn't fight back. You know, when I was assaulted, or I didn't fight back when somebody did this horrible thing to me.
Yeah, I mean, that is just so powerful, and obviously not just for the client or survivor, but I think also too for the therapist, because it kind of gives us a very different perspective from which to work, and it's almost very hopeful too, in a sense, to me.
Absolutely. And it's really changed the way that we understand treatment as well. It's my understanding that in the 80s and then even beyond that, there was this thinking from service providers in healthcare and in counseling that, and in fact, was even used in court as a defense, you know, why didn't you fight back? And so then this victim was being re-traumatized unintentionally by counselors and healthcare professionals. And so now we know that this is just nonsense, and that in fact people The nervous system has its own language, and people respond given the way that they're, you know, it's not a thinking brain exercise. It's our nervous system and our fight, flight, freeze response. So,
yeah. I love that. The nervous system has its own language.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, that's Dr. Porges that's brought that to light. And his work is so inspiring and brilliant. I remember the first time I read that, I had to sit back for a few minutes and just take that in.
we're going to have that linked up, Stephen Porges linked up at the show notes page here at thetraumatherapistproject.com. All right. So how did you get here? I mean, you've done this amazing group. You're, well seasoned in this work. Talk to us. Tell us the story about how you got here, Crystal.
Yeah, so I started my career as a youth worker, and I worked at a shelter for street entrenched youth years ago. And there I was asked to do an assessment on each youth on my caseload to inform treatment and goals that they wanted to work on, because they couldn't stay in the shelter for a long period. They had to leave after a certain period of time. And what I noticed, I worked in that shelter for 10 years, and what I noticed over and over and over again was, yes, there was addiction, and that was sort of highlighted at the time as sort of being the primary problem, or there was mental health. Actually, mental health wasn't as primary as substance abuse or addiction at the time. But what I noticed over and over was that trauma was the foundation, that almost always in the assessment, in the history, there would be childhood abuse, neglect, physical abuse, sexual abuse, or historical trauma, dislocation of First Nations, racism. And so I started to refer the youth out, and I, you know, because my job was to get resources in place and help youth get the support they needed. And unfortunately, in that area, in my area at that time, there just was a lack of good therapists that really understood how to treat trauma. And so I remember thinking, wow, I'm really going to have to think about this when I go back to school. Is this something that I want to do? And so that really inspired me. And when I did go back to school, that was something that I knew was a gap. There was a real need for this. And I thought, well, maybe I can go back, get my master's, specialize in this and affect some change. And so far it's worked out. Well, I'm hoping I'm affecting some change anyways.
So you're a young clinician, you're working in this shelter, this youth shelter, you're meeting all these, how old were these kids?
16 to 22.
Okay. And you're asked to do these assessments, but this other stuff is really kind of rearing its face in a sense, and it's becoming obvious what's going on here. I'm wondering if you can share, were there any particular experiences or clients that jump out to you that you can share with us what that experience was like, realizing that or coming to terms with that or recognizing that, oh my God, there's something else going on here?
Yeah, well, I remember talking to my my colleagues about it and my supervisors about it. And I mean, it was kind of interesting because there was this sense of powerlessness among most of us. Because I wasn't alone in seeing this over and over again. And at that particular time, we just didn't have any resources. I'm going to mention a little bit earlier or later on about a particular experience. I guess I can just touch on it now, where I experienced, unfortunately, a client who had experienced tremendous neglect in their history and eventually suicided. And that for me was kind of the turning point in my career, because I had come to a place where I realized that not only was I powerless, the client was powerless, but the kind of treatment that this person needed just wasn't there. And I think that was really the event that got me thinking and inspired me. I didn't go right away. I went several years later back to school, but that person never left me.
Wow, yeah.
That experience never left my, it'll be with me forever, that experience. Yeah.
Was there or is there something about you that you felt, you know, you were able to step into this role? I mean, it's one thing to say or to realize, you know, all these kids have been traumatized. Let me refer them out. And it's quite another thing to say, you know what, I kind of feel that I can maybe help them or sit with them. What, talk to us about how you kind of owned that or moved into that role in a sense.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I actually didn't have a lot of confidence in the beginning. And I was kind of mentored into it. So that was the one thing that was pretty interesting. I made a decision that I wanted to do it, but I knew I was really good at working with youth. But when I went back, because it was something that I seemed to do well and the youth seemed to respond to me really well. And I had some very good relationships over the years. But when I went back to grad school, I was really encouraged to start working with adults. And I didn't want to do it, I got to be honest. It was quite daunting to me to switch from youth to adults. And then I got a practicum in palliative care and oncology. And that was a very, very challenging experience. especially going from youth to that. But what I learned in that experience was, you know, at the end of the day, it's really, if you understand compassion, you understand empathy, you have empathy, it's really just about honing those skills and honing the listening skills. And then from there, I think I really developed the competence to work with adults, which then led me to start specializing in the trauma, learning about the trauma. And then I was mentored by some very fabulous EMDR psychologists who really encouraged me to keep going. Wow. And honestly, if I didn't have these wonderful mentors in my life, I don't think I would be doing what I'm doing. So I've been very fortunate.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying here is gold. I like to refer to it as just therapy gold. I mean, it's just so helpful, Crystal, for people who are getting into this field, for people who have been into this field to hear you talk about and share your experiences like this. I mean, to say that, you know what, I was kind of scared or, you know, I knew I wanted to do it, but I was kind of scared and the mentoring really helped me. And again, it's something we talk a lot about on this podcast, the importance of finding a mentor, finding a support network, a support group, a consultation group, someone who has kind of walked that path in a sense to guide you. It's crucial.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is.
Let's move on here. This is okay. Awesome. I love talking to you. Share with us a kind of early error you made and you know, what you learned from that.
Yeah. You know, when I first started in the field, I think the biggest error that I made was falling into the trap of fixing and rescuing. And, you know, when someone comes into my office, and I, you know, this was true in crises work, but it's still something I have to be mindful of, even today. And they're desperate, and there's a sense of hopelessness and powerlessness. Often the button that gets pushed for me first is, oh God, I've got to fix this. Mm-hmm. I've got to somehow rescue this person. It probably comes from my social work background as well. But, and so in the early days, I did end up making that mistake quite a bit. And I ended up getting into power struggles. This goes back to working with youth. And I learned that at the end of the day, you know, the outcome is up to the client. And it doesn't matter how much I rescue or fix, that person is going to do what they need to do in their time, in their way. And so that was something I had to learn.
Yeah. What do you say to the people who are listening, who are maybe just getting into this field, and they're like, well, wait a minute, what's wrong with trying to help somebody? What's wrong with someone comes into my office and they're hurting? What's wrong with trying to fix them and make them better?
Yeah, and that's a good question. That's an excellent point, because I just want to clarify quickly. If someone comes into my office and they say to me, you know, I want to kill myself, I have a duty at that point to pick up the phone and do what I have to do to keep that person safe. So there will be times where I need to take action. But when someone comes into my office and there's a sense of desperation or powerlessness, and I feel the need to give advice, tell them what to do, how to get themselves out of that. I'm not really doing that person any favors, because what I'm doing is I'm not allowing them to explore on their own a way to solve it. But also, I'm not giving them the dignity or even the self-agency to be able to come to these results themselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And also with the rescuing and the fixing, well, I mean, like it's like treating someone like a child, right? It's a tempting thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think most people do it at some point. But I think it's really important to know when that button's being pushed, I need to fix or try to change this. Being able to step back and say, it's okay to be uncomfortable. That's what this person's brought into the office. We can sit with that. We can even name it if we need to, but we don't have to react to it. It's far more helpful for that person and myself to be able to have a dialogue of exploring that inner world, their inner world, and what that is for them, than to try to put the Band-Aid on it fast.
Was it hard for you to get to that point, or was it challenging?
Oh, God, yes, extremely. And I mean, even today, I mean, I'm constantly, I go for supervision regularly, which I think is very important. And I will constantly check in with myself around, you know, I had a psychiatrist in training teach me this. He said that whenever you feel something strongly in the room with a client, know that that's the transference. And you have an opportunity at that point to react to it, which would be countertransference, or to step back and just notice it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like being mindful around the transference. Mm-hmm. Just notice it. You know, you don't have to react to it. Just notice it. And then recognize that that is so powerful for the client, that that's what you're feeling right now. And I thought that for me, that was really a powerful teaching moment.
Yeah,
I really felt that to be, I mean, I still take that with me day by day with clients.
Yeah, I love that awareness, that kind of calling for us to keep that awareness level high, that self-awareness level high for ourselves. All right, so I really want to hear about your group, in a sense, the Making Sense of Trauma and how that came about. But before we do, let's talk about and kind of highlight your why. Why are you doing this work? What's pulling you, kind of calling you day to day to continue doing this?
Yeah. You know, I'm really lucky because as an EMDR therapist, I've been able to witness some pretty powerful sessions with people actually getting their lives are changing. You know, that these insights that change their way of viewing things and their way of behaving, their quality of life changing. So I'm pretty lucky that way. You know, the why for me has a lot to do with my own history. You know, I was an actor back in the day, and in my acting, it's kind of interesting how these two worlds kind of cross over at times. What I learned as an actor is that most of my friends had survived these homes that were quite tumultuous, I guess that's the right word, or chaotic. And I remember being in theater school, and, you know, all of us were kind of screwed up. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that we had come from homes where there was sort of this drama. And I had a lot of friends who had survived, the ACOA. So they were kind of recovering from parents who were alcoholic. And then I had friends who were recovering from this. And so I already kind of had a good lesson early in life about what it is to kind of be around it and survive it. And I had also gone into my own psychotherapy when I was young and done my own work. And so I knew that one day I might become a therapist, but I wasn't really 100% sure. I thought I would be an Oscar-winning actress first. But that didn't work out. So what ended up happening was I became so passionate about working with people that I just knew that this was the path that, you know, acting was fun, but this was the path that was really something that I felt was a calling. It's really humbling and rewarding to be able to be in a position where I can offer treatment and watch some people. You know, they do the work. I get to watch while they do the work. And I watch some people just, you know, really, I see their lives change in wonderful ways.
That's awesome. You know, as you were talking about your history with EMDR, I'm sitting here shaking my head because I've had that done to me. I've been the recipient and it blew me away.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy. That's just for another episode. But yeah, so thank you so much for sharing that. Let's talk about this group, if that's okay. Can we?
Yes.
Because I want to, it just sounds very powerful for me. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I didn't think it was going to work. It was a pilot project. I asked my boss if I could do it. My boss said, sure, go ahead. I actually got turned down by several bosses because they said it was too complicated and nobody on the east side would understand it. And the east side is where a lot of marginalized clients reside because it's technically cheaper and easier to live down there. Although that's not really true anymore. But in those days, there were a lot of social services in that area. And so I couldn't understand why people kept saying, this is too complicated, you're never going to do it, nobody's going to come. And I, in some ways, I'm kind of glad they said no, because I'm a bit stubborn. And so what ended up happening is I thought, well, I'll show them. And so it just made me work harder. And so I ended up putting together this 7-week kind of, well, actually, it's kind of like a program that talks about how trauma affects the brain and nervous system. And I was so lucky because I had these wonderful clients that became peer helpers. Wow. And they would come to me each group and help me shape this group in a way that was client-centered and friendly. So, and they would say, you know what, you got to throw this out. It's too complicated. You got to keep this. You got to, you know, so really this group was, the members really created this group. They were the ones that also gave me excellent feedback each week. And what ended up happening is the first group that I ran, we had, I think it was close to 16 or 17 people. No, actually it was 30 people that showed up, but we only had 15 seats. We had to turn half of them away. Wow. And then I went to my boss and I said, look, this is in huge demand. Like my phone's ringing off the hook. I had no idea that people were needing this information so badly. And he said, neither did I. So we ended up running it for three and a half years. And it's still in demand. It's still something that people talk about and want to get into and are really excited about. And the great thing about this group is it's not a group about talking about trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's a psychoeducational group where we teach grounding skills each week on how to deal with the nervous system when we're activated. And what I learned from clients is they said to me, you know, all I needed was to know I wasn't crazy. And I don't even feel like I need to go for any counseling. I just needed this group. And that was a learning experience for me because, you know, here I am, this trauma, you know, EMDR therapist. And I'm thinking, you know, they'll go through the group and then we'll do the treatment. And then, you know, then we'll get the meaning stage of stage three. And it was quite interesting. I learned that actually education is a pretty, pretty powerful thing for people. Wow. And that in itself can move people. You know, just that sense of I'm not crazy anymore can change people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many great kind of, you know, gold nuggets and bits of wisdom in a lot of what you're saying here. What, and I kind of want to segue into this time for you to share some advice for people just getting into this field. What do you think the takeaway is for our listeners here from that experience?
Oh, wow. The takeaway. So I guess, you know, I think the bottom line, and you know, we talk about this in the group as well, is that it's just so important. You know, we're in an information age anyways. So it's changed a little bit. But I still feel like, I don't know how it is in the States, but in Canada, there's still this kind of interesting lack of transparency in mental health. Mm-hmm. There's still this kind of, don't talk about it, you know, mm-hmm. just give the diagnosis, but don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Or heaven forbid, educate about it. It's just this weirdness that I don't really understand. I think that the bottom line is that people deserve as much information as they can get. Mm-hmm. They deserve as much education as they can get. I think it should be free. It shouldn't be something you have to go and pay extraordinary amounts of money for to figure out how PTSD affects the brain and nervous system. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in our system, we need to get better at being transparent and in educating people so that they don't just walk around with these labels mm-hmm. and not understand what that means. And then the labels become a way for the self-esteem to kind of go in the toilet. And then there's this, well, what's the point? And they just kind of give up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's useful or that makes sense, but.
No, definitely it is. Yeah.
So one of the things that we talk about in the group is the importance of, you know, share this, mm-hmm. share the love, tell everyone, you know, like get it out there. This isn't a secret. It's not a dirty secret. You know, this is the reality of what happens when you have PTSD. This is the reality of what happens when you survive complex trauma. You're not crazy. This is it. And for some reason, it's been a kind of a mystery for a number of years. And I'm not sure why that is, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the research that's come out in the past 30 years has been quite rapid, and it's, there's been a lot of information in the past little while that wasn't there 30 years ago. So that might have something to do with it too.
Let's continue in this vein here. What else would you say or advise people who are just getting into this field of trauma, kind of beginning their trauma education journey in a sense? What would you say to them?
I would say that it's really important to take care of yourself, to have a really good sense of your own history, mm-hmm. and to have a good ability to self-locate yourself within your history. So what that means is knowing, you know, when you're activated, knowing some of your buttons, knowing where you come from, understanding, you know, where you intersect with race and oppression and some of the different trauma that you are going to come up against in your office. Are you going to be uncomfortable with that and why? And just also getting a good sense of, also like we talked about, having very good supervision mm-hmm. and being able to regularly kind of go for your own supervision. For me, that includes personal work as well. It's kind of rotating between supervision and then my own personal work and then supervision, because I want to stay kind of lean mm-hmm. in the field. You know, this is my way of staying fit, because otherwise it can get tricky. It can get tricky if you're starting it, your own stuff starts coming into it, and you can burn out, and it can be devastating for the therapist if they burn out.
Awesome. So again, I'm going to have all this linked up at the show notes page at thetraumatherapistpodcast.com. Hit on Crystal's tab and all this will come right up. Crystal, we talked a little bit about this before we started, about your go-to book. What do you want to go with here?
Yeah. So, you know, I guess the book that I'm reading right now, because there's so many, is The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. I mean, that book's just awesome.
It is awesome. Yep.
Yeah. And I refer to it quite a bit before I do my trauma group as well, just to make sure that I'm on top of the brain and the nervous system and that kind of thing. Okay. And that's probably the book I'm reading now. I mean, I could go on and on about the books, but I don't think I will. I don't want to overwhelm people. The other one, Peter Levine, Waking the Tiger. That's another really good book.
Okay. Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body and Healing of Trauma by Bessel van der Kolk, and Waking the Tiger by Peter Levine. We'll have, again, both those linked up here at the show notes page. What's the best way for people to get in contact with you, Crystal?
Yeah, so the best way is to go to my website, www.crystalarbor.com. So that's just my name.
Okay.
And you can just email me from there.
www.crystalarber.com. Awesome.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have that linked up. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. This was awesome. I mean, this was like when I first had the desire to do this podcast, this is something that I would have loved to listen to. I mean, you just like sprinkled this interview with all these like little inspirational nuggets and like, yeah. So,
that's
so
awesome.
Yeah, seriously. And, I so appreciate it. So, anytime you want to come back on here, shoot me an email and I'll do the same. I'd love to have you back.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, Crystal. Take care.
Bye.
Hey folks, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to and support this podcast. Look, if you're new to this field and you're starting out with your trauma-informed education, I invite you to check out my rebooted membership site, Trauma Therapist 2.0. Trauma Therapist 2.0 is an online community which offers education, support, and inspiration for people working with trauma clients. Trauma Therapist 2.0 consists of instructional videos from the thought leaders and game changers in this field, step-by-step videos on interventions by myself, and it also includes a private Facebook group. I price Trauma Therapist 2.0 at $20 a month with the goal of making it available to students and professionals alike. Head on over to traumatherapist2.com. That's all one word, traumatherapist2.com, and join me on this amazing journey.